We have craft that defies physics as we know it and is moving at speeds that are at least 100 times faster than anything a human or a robot or any kind of material science can produce on the planet. Okay, that's a global and national risk factor.
Do we have something to fear or do we not? And if we have something to fear, please tell us what that is. And moreover, if we have something to fear and you're telling us what that is, what are you doing about it?
This is The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisbert, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Rachel Melling. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the evolution of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can follow us on social media at Army Mad Sci, or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Today we're talking with frequent guests, Dr. James Giordano and Dr. James Canton. We'll talk with them today about unmanned anomalous phenomena, or UAPs, their capabilities, and what this means for national security. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or the Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started. So we've had you both on the show before, but can you remind our audience, give us a quick little background of who you are and why you're on the show today? So Dr. Canton, let's start with you.
Well, thanks for having us back. My background is I run the Institute for Global Futures, which is a think tank that advises government, defense, but mostly the private sector, where I've had most of my background, was involved early days with technology at Apple Computer, ran business for Steve Jobs, then simultaneously have worked with four administrations, White House administrations, focused specifically on the scope of advanced and emerging technologies, was the first nanoscience, nanoengineering advisor of the National Science and Technology Council, where I was appointed under two other administrations, everything around emerging technologies, nanobio, IT, neuro, quantum, and now quantum, National Science Foundation, then of course, a broad, let's say, private and public sector focused on what's coming next. And I'm a futurist. I write books and I advise people about how to minimize risk and also think about the future or how to be more future smart.
Sure. I'm Dr. Jim Giordano. I'm a neuroscientist, neuropathologist by training with additional training in political philosophy of science and ethics. I'm currently the Pellegrino Center professor in the departments of neurology and biochemistry at Georgetown, where I also head up our program in neuroethics and our program in brain science and global health law and policy. As well, I serve as the executive director of the Institute for Biodefense Research, which is a governmentally funded think tank that examines those ways that contemporary science, chem and biosciences, together with convergent sciences like big data and AI, are able to impact our biosecurity, our public health, and what that means for national intelligence, security, and defense. My ongoing work is I also work with the Strategic Multi-Level Assessment Branch of the Joint Staff Pentagon as one of their senior fellows in neural and cognitive sciences, a pleasure that I've had for the past 15 to 20 years. And I'm prior service. I was a flight doc, served with the United States Navy and Marine Corps.
All right. So today, what we're going to be talking about are unidentified aerial phenomena, or UAPs, which have been in the news a lot recently and over the past year. So can you both explain to our listeners what you've been seeing in this realm and the resulting disruptive S&T?
Let me just jump in real quickly to make sure that we get the UAP thing correctly. We moved away from aerial, where now the A is unidentified anomalous phenomena, because the presence of these, as I'll hand over to Jamie in a moment, has not been limited to those things that are aerial, but also involve different environmental domains. Jamie, over to you.
Thanks, Jim. So here's a futurist kind of paradigm, how to think about, you know, what's going on. So there have been a lot of reports recently that seem to cut across activities that have been going on for the better part of more than 50 to 60 years that have been some, quite frankly, outrageous. Now, as a social scientist, you know, a PhD, I'm bound by some of the same rules that Jim is, that what is, you know, science-based investigation, where's the evidence? What does that evidence look like? So I'd like to differentiate between the reports, which there have been a lot of them. There have been, and I'll go through just a couple of the reports, and then we'll take a look at the evidence. And in fact, I'll do them together. There have been reports by very, let's say, auspicious, credentialed people, rear admirals, individuals who have been captains, Navy captains. There have been a variety of parties and agencies stood up to address all this. I'm going to deal with those reports. Many of those reports, which are about the most outrageous ones, that there's non-human biological artifacts, if you will, some kind of materials, that the government is you know, got all kinds of information that there is secret and it's in SAPs and all of that. That is, there's craft and reverse technology of craft that has gone on for a very long period of time. There is evidence of all kinds of events that have occurred, some of which we have videos on and different kinds of radar flare and other things. So those are three of the categories. And yes, they've been under the sea. There's been observations. So in each of these reports, and I'm not bound as Jim is, in the sense that I'm not currently engaged, you know, in a contract or a SAP or anything else. I can talk as a free party, even though I have national security clearance in the past. I have to, you know, pay attention to what I've done in that area. But I would say many of these reports have no evidence whatsoever. They're great reports. All right. So, you know, at the end of the day, there has been no evidence that I'm aware of, both briefed to Congress or in the media or in any authoritative parties, that have indicated that these things are true. I have not. The only thing we have seen, which is uncorroborated, is that there are videos of craft. There's videos of aviators discussing what's going on in real time. And all of that is very interesting, right? So what we know is there may be these other events, but as a science-based social scientist looking at all of this, until I have corroborable, you know, evidence that indicates what that is, other than, for all intents and purposes, reports by very credentialed people that I have no reason to not agree with, I need more evidence to see what's going on. In fact, I think that we're at that critical juncture to be able to determine how much of it is real, Hemerson. Let's put all of that aside. Here's my science frame, and I'll expand it. Okay, let's accept that there is a phenomena, a UAP phenomena, that is not well understood, that we have some evidence, right? Putting aside, you know, the reports, uncorroborated, but there are corroborated. We've seen videos. The former Assistant Secretary for Defense under Obama, his last day in office, he released a series of videos, which we've come to see, and it's caused a concern. We also have reports by the Pentagon, by defense establishment, indicating that these videos, notice, these reports of flying objects called UAPs are anomalous, as Jim pointed out, meaning we don't know. We're not exactly sure what they are. I think that's the most honest evidence that we can now proceed with. I'm going to accept the scenario that this phenomena exists right now, and it's been seen by, again, my institute, for the Institute for Global Futures. We've done an analysis with our AI friends to analyze the corpus of material out there. And there's about 15 countries that have shared intel, interestingly, even adversaries, about these UAPs flying and being seen at sea. And at the end of the day, I want everybody to take away for this audience that it represents a national and global security risk. Why? Because we don't understand it, one. Two, they seem to really like to hang out around destroyers, military bases. Okay, that's very interesting. So from a reconnaissance point of view, we have craft that represents science that defies physics as we know it and is moving at speeds that are at least 100 times faster than anything a human or a robot or any kind of material science can produce on the planet. Okay. That's a global and national risk factor, and we should recognize that. Whether it's terrestrial, extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional, which I'll be glad to opine about, is really the interesting question, because we have a national security risk that for the first time in the history of the planet, certainly our nation, we don't have an understanding about. So as a scientist, I'm really excited about that. And I think that this is a fantastic investigation of which we're all involved in, but we have a different charge, which is to look at this from a national security point of view. And it definitely poses a national security risk because we don't know what it is. We don't know who it is. And we're now at the speculative analysis stage of what this is. And I'll be glad to expand on the science, particularly, which is, you know, my charge, as is Jim's. Back to you, Jim.
Thanks, Jamie. So let me just provide the listeners with a little bit of the recent history of this. So there were two congressional hearings. One and the first was back in July, where Mr. Gresh, essentially the primary, quote, whistleblower, accompanied by former Commander Graver and Lieutenant Gray, both naval aviators, reported to a congressional committee that, in fact, A, there was evidence of these phenomena, UAP, unidentified, at that point still aerial, but now anomalous phenomena. Number two, the evidence was multidimensional and multi-domain, so it involves not only various forms of electromagnetic sensing, but also forms of radar signatures that would suggest there's going to be a feedback, so not just something like an infrared artifact or some other form of electromagnetic sensing artifact, but these were multiple traces on radar that were then identifiable, as well as visual reports. And these were corroborated over the years and were also then correlated to prior visual reports. Now, what came out of that was also that there was indeed a series of government programs. Probably the one that's most familiar to your listeners is Project Blue Book. But subsequently to that, a number of other programs that then examined what these types of things, formerly called UFOs, unidentified flying objects, represented, were. And here's where things get muddy. That information was received and acquired, accumulated, and this information was not released either in military circles as appropriate and or to the congressional committees that provided military intelligence oversight. Now, that's sort of the ethical slap on the wrist. But the larger issue is, well, what information, number one, and number two, what was received? Was it simply information by virtue of knowledge about various forms of data, things that happened, events, or were there actually physical attributes in some way that were recovered, going as far back perhaps as Roswell, if not prior? Well, coming from that was then a second congressional hearing that was chaired by Congresswoman Mace. And at that hearing were Admirals Gallaudet, Mr. Lou Elizondo, Mr. Gold, and Mr. Schellenberger, Mr. Schellenberger being a journalist. And I think probably most importantly was the declassification and therefore public distribution of a document called the Immaculate Constellation Program. Now, I don't want to probe into that too deeply, and that is now available, by the way, on the internet, and you can actually get at least executive summaries of both that program and the document. What the document essentially revealed was, just as I said, that there have been decades long evidence that there's something there, and this represents some form of reality. Now, coming from that, and I think very notably, was a Senate hearing in which the director of now a Department of Defense agency specifically tasked with examining these phenomena, investigating these phenomena, and increasing the relative not only governmental but public transparency. Well, the director of that program, Dr. Kozlowski, then testified before the Senate. And I think there are some important takeaways from all this information, and as they were specifically summarized by Dr. Kozlowski, because this now represents a very formalized position. Please understand also for your listeners that nothing that I'm saying here comes in any of my official capacities working through the Department of Defense or any one of the other government agencies or institutions that so generously support my work, for which I'm currently working in an operational contract role. Interestingly, I think if one wants to get a little bit of both read ahead and or read aside, and this is not a plug in any way, but Mr. Lou Elizondo, who's chaired and has been involved with a variety of these programs nominally over the past decades, has just released a book that has been cleared by the United States government, Department of Defense and intelligence agencies, called Imminent. And I recommend that to the listeners very, very highly. And the reason for that is that Mr. Elizondo has left in those aspects of his book that have been redacted. In other words, you can see where certain aspects of his text were redacted by the powers that be, within fairly high levels working to be able to preserve relative integrity of these special access programs. So I do recommend that highly, because I think if nothing else, it provides a bit of not only the history, but the historicity of these events and their relevance. But let's have some takeaways here. The takeaways here are that the majority of these reports, I mean, we're talking 98%, are identifiable as some extant entity that it represents a known current technology, or maybe some form of meteorological event that is then clarified and verified. A celestial event, for example, a mechanical satellite, satellite artifact, or literally some celestial event is some way then obfuscated, declarified, or ambiguated by the atmosphere that numbers of people then report. But this is verifiable. In other words, these things happened. They're observable events in space that are either planetary or stellar. And as a consequence, due to these factors, they were observed in this way, or some known aerial and or other forms of spacecraft. As I said, either satellites and or weather balloons, helicopters, state-of-the-art aeronautical technologies, drones, etc. As well, some of the video reports that have been shown that were evidence of United States aircraft, military aircraft, forward-looking infrared sensors, most notably the Go Fast film and the High-Low film, as they've been called, seem to be some type of sensor artifact, either a motion parallax and positional parallax of the aircraft and the gimbaling sensor itself, then coupled with differentials in altitude that were then perceived as being something going very, very fast, but in essence were not. It was the aircraft that was going very fast, coupled to the gimbaling action of the forward-looking or multidimensional infrared that then produced these types of images. However, let's cut those to the side. You also have visual reports, and these are visual reports by a number of individuals whose notoriety it cannot be in any way impugned. These are professional pilots, both military as well as commercial, as well as a number of individuals on the ground, military individuals, public safety individuals, who the extent of their reports, the gravitas of their reports, the granularity of their reports and subsequent questioning are beyond doubt. So what we're talking about here is about 1 to 1.5% of reported UAP events that are not categorizable as those things that are identifiable as extant entities of current technology or meteorological events or celestial events. But it's the impact of those. I mean, what are those things? These are recognized to be real. Dr. Kozlowski acknowledged these are real. And it's not just a question of saying these are unidentified, but in parameters of our current known science and technologies, do not fit well into categorizable entities by virtue of their physical properties or other characteristics that they exhibit. And as a consequence, the anomalous nature of these phenomena is preservable, is real, and this also represents at least a potential burden. I mean, look, let's face it. We call our species Homo sapiens, the knowable humans. We like to know things. We have a need to know. And as Jamie alluded to, and quite accurately, if we don't know all the facts, we tend to make stuff up. I mean, there's this thin line between what represents mythos, a myth that has some explanatory fiction, and logos, a rational accounting based upon what we know. But when we come to the limits of what we know, and we're still faced with a multidimensional, multi-present reality, at that point, now we're pressed. What is this? What does this represent? And when trying to calculate whether there's some risk or potential threat, the first thing you have to look at from a military standpoint is the technology or capability there? And for sure it is. And the second thing you have to ask is, what is the intent? And that's where you really open a potential Pandora's jar of the need for clarity and transparency, in particular ways that still preserve what may be national security interests, but certainly is able to communicate to the public that type of information that is beneficial and therefore respectful of public health and benefit.
So then my next question is, what's the threat here?
So first of all, the threat is, speaking as somebody who's worked on most of the advanced emerging technologies over, you know, the better part of 30 years, let me acknowledge, which we haven't heard in this discussion in general, the dilemma that the Defense Department and U.S. government is in. Because being the leading superpower in the world, at the end of the day, this is an existential threat to our hegemony as a superpower, okay? So there is nothing more, you know, there's nothing bigger than that. And I say that because looking back, we've invested in every major technology that has changed the world for the better. You think about it, you know, Moore's Law, doubling technology every, used to be 2 years, then it went to a year, and now it's 20 minutes. AI, mapping the human genome. You think about these advanced technologies that create industries, create jobs, increase the quality of life for everybody on the planet. I mean, this is the history of what the United States has done. There have been a few other folks outside of it that have done that, but we basically led this innovation economy, which I talk about in my books, The Future Smart. So what? Here's the real threat. Threat is that we don't know. All of a sudden, there is an actor playing on our planet at this time that has superior technology, period. We're going to go into a little bit about what the science and all that, but let's just accept what's really freaking everybody out. And it should be, whether you're in the Defense Department or, you know, you're another nation. By the way, the same thing that's going on with us has also been observed, as I indicated earlier, by at least 20 other countries. Okay, so that's a threat matrix right there. Now, let's just go to it. Okay, let's talk about putting aside the technology for the moment. Let's say, okay, what does that threat matrix look like? Well, there is a party, and clearly it's a rogue party that, forget about where they're from, or what, that's on our planet, operating in our space, that has superior speed, technology, capability that surpasses anything we or any of our adversaries or partners on the planet have. That's the major risk. And we can't control it. If you analyze the various videos as such and observances, when we've attempted to follow these craft, for instance, they outpace us by speed. They outpace us by disappearing into the ocean because they have superior technology. So, of course, the top of the threat matrix stack from a strategic planning point of view is when advanced technologies utilized by a society encounter a more primitive society that does not have that level, whether it's steel or fire or nuclear or you name it, the decline of that civilization has been true. So what does that mean for us? We have made contact, by the way. We have contact. What's the contact? It's in our airspace. So it's already here. That's a form of contact. Contact is not just communication. They are communicating. They are sending signals. Now, I have to now go with, okay, who are likely actors that have a motive for that? And what does that end game look like? Okay, because they become more aggressive and more intrusive. And as Jim pointed out earlier, you know, there may be risks associated with that, but I can tell you the biggest risk is not knowing who the actors are, two, what their intentions are, three, we have no communication with them, but they have made contact because they're here. Now, who are they? Where do they come from? Okay, we have made some assumptions that because we believe, again, the official statement is that Pentagon has indicated there is no adversary, there is no partner that has this technology. Okay, I'm going to challenge that. I'm going to say maybe there is a terrestrial party that is operating as a rogue who has figured out how to use, or there's a state actor who has enabled a party to demonstrate that. And by the way, this is not a binary analysis. It's not the Russians and or the Chinese or North Koreans or a private sector. It's a non-binary phenomena. Why? Some of the phenomena may be a fantastic advertisement for new technology that emerges on the planet, because what we do know is it's not threatening. It hasn't shot at, attacked, kidnapped. It has not engaged in any kind of hostile intentions, though there have been some reports about the turning on and off of nuclear facilities, on weapon systems, on destroyers. Again, these are reports, and I have no reason to believe they're true or not true. I accept the veracity of the credentials of the people who have said that. So that may be the beginning of something. Okay. But I want to say that a terrestrial party, a rogue party, that's number one. Could be. I'm just saying it could be. We just assume that we have the biggest and the baddest technology, and I'm just saying the other solution is it may be a fantastic advertisement for a friendly, which has self-spawned something, self-developed something. Now, we're going to say that's not impossible. We have this linear way of thinking. I'm saying, you know, we have all kinds of technology and parties, contractors, and I've been a contractor for, you know, a couple of decades. I would say there's as much possibility that's rogue, that because it has not indicated a hostile intent, that they have indicating and they are showcasing certain technology that we're all talking about. I have to assume that that scenario, that it's terrestrial, and I could go on, that there are parties that would be in their interest to do that. That's number one. Number two, why would we think that this is not how we operate? Think about it. The immense, let's make believe for a moment. Let's take on the scenario that it's extraterrestrial. What do? We send drones, we send probes that take generations, you know, 50 years or 100 years to get someplace, and we can't even communicate with them after a period of time. Why would we assume if there were, and let's accept for a moment, you know, that there are other civilizations, there are other life forms, what would they do? Well, they kind of do what we do. And therefore, you know, you might look at that as, okay, let's accept that there's a scenario that says that there is some extraterrestrial, and what would they do? They'd send a drone. They would send not necessarily people, they'd send a telerobotic or some kind of AI. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. In the game of making, coming up with forecasts, you don't throw stuff out. You say, throw everything at the wall and say, what's going to stick? Okay, that's number two. Number three is extra dimensional. We know quantum mechanics allows for there to be extra and higher dimensions. We know that. We only operate in three dimensions. We already know multiple universe theory, and we'll get into any of that if we have the time. But the point is, there is a dimensional piece to all of this, which has been hinted about in some of the reports. Okay, that is consistent, guess what, with our physics, quantum mechanics. I'll give you a simple example right now. Crows. Crows, everybody thinks, are black. Actually, they're a kaleidoscope of colors. You don't see them. I don't see them because the spectrum of sight that we have is not sophisticated enough to see all the colors. A dog smells about 100,000 times with more finite specificity than we do. And these are, quote, lower life forms. So what could they be? Are they time travelers? I'm not going there. Is it possible that they're ghost vibrations or events that are occurring that are extra dimensional, that pop in and pop out based on what we're beginning? Think about what entanglement is, where two events are in communication with each other, or quantum tunneling. And that technology, by the way, nobody, as far as I know, even though there have been reports, has a craft or a creature yet to explain to us where it comes from. In other words, what I'm saying is all of these scenarios of extra dimensional, extraterrestrial, and terrestrial have to be examined if we're going to do a proper holistic threat matrix. And the last one, I'll hint at it, is my favorite one is artificial intelligence. Why would we think we're the only folks in the world that are using AI specifically? What I'm saying is AI already exists in the wild. And what I mean by that is we already have a new synthetic evolution of computer math-based evolution. So why would we assume that AI does not have the ability in the form of synthetic evolution to be able to propagate itself, and therefore utilizing our networks and utilizing material science propagate something? Now, that's going to sound outrageous. And I could tell you there's lots of outrageous things that have occurred to us from a defense and intelligence point of view that we wish we could go ahead and take back, have led to things like 9/11 or led to other kinds of threats and led to invention. We're in an exponential explosion of innovations, of convergent innovations, where we're actually using AI to show us what the convergence are. Why would there not be a covert rogue AI that have the ability to play and experiment? I think the horse has already left the barn. So that's another scenario. I'm not saying that's it. I'm saying, but we have to kind of look at the landscape of scenarios and then be aware that we're going to be surprised. Rumsfeld talked specifically about it's the knowns, the unknowns, and the unknown unknown. So I think we're in that domain right now, and I suspect we're going to discover some new opportunities, and they're not the usual suspects.
In the congressional of a couple of weeks ago, Chairwoman Mace and Mr. Ogles, if I can paraphrase a very important statement, said that these types of hearings, coupled with the existing data that are now becoming both declassified and for which there is now going to be an increased, I think, urgency, if not call, for relative transparency, really pushing the door open a little wider. But I think with that comes a responsibility. I mean, look, if you're going to open the front door, and that's what we're doing here, you want to know what's on the other side, right? I mean, if you're going to open the door to your house and you're saying, all right, these things are real and there's something out there, well, what is it? So one of the things that our group is very concerned about is realizing, if you will, in other words, making real and identifying, both qualifying and quantifying, what the potential burdens, risks, and threats might be. And realistically, let me summarize some of the stuff that Jamie said and frame this within essentially a risk space, right? A viable, identifiable, and then hopefully mitigable risk space. And part of that mitigation could come from simple transparency. Does it exist, this risk? No. Does that risk exist? No. Yes or no. And if it does, well, then what is the preparedness for that? The first, obviously, is that there's some type of peer competitor or adversarial entity that have some intent on penetrating our national security boundaries, our national geographic and geopolitical boundaries. And of course, this occurs elsewhere. So when this is occurring, then you have to say, well, who's doing this, as Jamie said? What does this represent? And this has particular risk as regard national security, military hegemony, and to some extent, perhaps political hegemony. But if we just take that a little bit further, and we ask the question of attribution, is it ours? And in full disclosure, we say, no, it isn't ours. And then we ask, is it yours? And they say, wait a minute, the thing's happening here too, and it's not ours. They think it's ours. Well, then there is an issue there. If you have two sides that are pointing fingers at each other about these things that appear to be some at least risk to what a particular nation may perceive as its national security integrity, and as Jamie alluded to and explicated, there is an increased presence of these types of things being observed, sensed, and reported around what would be national security assets, not only in the United States, but elsewhere. Part of that could be sensing bias. I mean, you know, if you're looking more in one particular place, you're going to see things more in one particular place. And if there's been a relative stigma or a bias against certain reports coming from elsewhere, well, you're going to see a decreased number of reports coming from elsewhere. But to just balance those out, let's just say for a moment that indeed the frequency of these reports is veridically representative of where these things are happening. Well, no, then you get back into sort of a fail-safe motive. If we're saying, hey, wait a minute, we're saying a lot of these things around our national security assets that therefore may be risky or threatening, and our peer competitors, come adversaries are saying the same thing, you don't want to start pointing fingers and saying, you're doing it, you're doing it. No, you're doing it. Because that could have an escalatory effect. So one potential risk that needs to be addressed is, are all parties involved confident that the veridicality of reporting saying it's not ours is something they can go with? Or might this be false flag planting? In other words, they're sending something over here, so we think it's them, but it really isn't. And what this then does is escalate to the point of crossing some bellicose threshold. In other words, is this provocative? You want to sort of at least identify that, and what are the risks of that threat escalating? The second are the physical properties of the actual devices themselves with regard to certain range effects. In other words, a dosimetry. If you get near to this thing, might there pose some risk to health, life, et cetera? Not only to humans, but to agricultural products, to animals, and perhaps to infrastructure and electromagnetic assets. The same is true not only of the device itself, but of the apparent propulsion. And the reason that may pose a risk is that it seems at this point that the mechanism of propulsion of these types of entities is unknown based upon the characteristics, the physical characteristics that they exhibit. The third is actual physical contact with some type of substance of the device itself. Physical contact with some trace that the device may have made, in other words, radiological exposure or some other form of exposure to perhaps electromagnetic frequency artifacts that might be risky for humans, animals, plants, etc. And or if the attribution that indeed there's some biological material that has been contained or recovered from these, well, what's that biological material? I mean, it doesn't have to be alien in the sense of saying, well, this is from somewhere else, some other planet or whatever. I mean, let's face it, if it's biological material that is identifiable as posing some burden, risk, threat, or harm, well, then the public needs to know that. if nothing else, to say simply don't go there, or yeah, we've got this under control. The fourth identifiable risk space is the risk of engagement. And we've had this happen before, where now these types of devices or these entities are encountered by military assets. And for whatever reason, the military asset will fire on this. It's happened once before. And the explanation there was, well, there was no way that this thing was going to be in range, but I just thought what I'd do is fire at it just to get a ranging to see how far away it was. This was coming from an Air Force pilot. Well, let's play that scenario through a little bit. I mean, if in fact these things are engaging with aircraft or other form of maritime assets, whether those are military, civilian, or commercial, and there is contact by virtue of collision, or there's contact by some other form of directed engagement, inclusive the fact that the thing engages our assets, in other words, human assets, known assets, well, what happens then? Not just, but if in fact there's something like a collision, let's just say that one of these aerial entities either collides with a commercial airliner, a military plane, a civilian plane, or induces some loss of control, then you have to begin to think about collateral effects upon the populace. Again, an issue. And I think the last, but not certainly the least, is the mass psychological effects. And the mass psychological effects, to our view, is at least twofold and perhaps three. Let me elucidate. The first is the mass psychological effect of not knowing. You know, we tend to be afraid of the thing that lurks under the bed, behind the closet, and humans don't like being in the dark. And when that happens, we make stuff up. And the psychological effect of making things up and doing this in a way that is directionally negatively valent could have deleterious effects on the population, on the mass psyche, and even on behavior. I mean, if people are thinking this is something that's going to cause them harm, and they then engage, and it's not harmful, number one, or if they then engage because they think they're seeing something that isn't really there and they end up opening fire on their next door neighbor who's flying a drone, you see the issue? So the idea of manifest psychological effects that are prompting some type of abreactive response in individuals or collective is a problem by not knowing. The second mass effect is that what tends to happen is there is a fear effect. And the fear effect can be compound. In other words, do we have something to fear or do we not? And if we have something to fear, please tell us what that is. And moreover, if we have something to fear and you're telling us what that is, what are you doing about it? So those are the two main psychological effects. The third is that it tends to create what's tend to know as a boundary effect, a cognitive or a psychological boundary effect. Let me explain. If there is some advanced narrative to suggest that this is a peer competitor's activity, cum adversary's activity, a rogue state, a non-state actor, well, then what happens there is it's an us versus them. And the them is somewhat ambiguated. In other words, who is this them? The problem with that is it can very often default to what is called the most common attributable actor. In other words, well, it's those Russians, it's those Chinese, it's those fill in the blank. And that us versus them binary mindset can then escalate into not only fear, but aggression, violence, etc. But there's a flip side of that coin. The other issue is, well, what if the us versus them is, who is that them? And is that them something that we have no idea of, which then can precipitate sort of a spiraling set of unknowns and a whole set of cognitions, emotions, and behaviors, both on the individual and collective level, that could be disruptive. So we have to consider those five potential risk spaces, not only in their mutual exclusivity, but in the dynamic of their interaction. And what we're calling for is at least some measure of governmental transparency to address those risks so as to valuably mitigate those risks, or at very least define the relative reality and ratio of probability of those risks in real time.
Let's go to the other side of the scenario, which is the antithesis of the threat matrix. You know, part of this is there's a notion that we need to be aware that there is a threat and what the risks are, whether it's, as Jim alluded, whether it's biological or whether it's hegemonic. My guess is if when I look at the scenario, I see a reasonable matrix there if I accept inside the extraterrestrial that there's a communication, not not green men or women piloting devices, but there are civilizations. We already know Fermi's hypothesis. We already know the statistics and the likelihood of there being in our galaxy, in the universe, life. Let's accept that as part of that scenario. If we were to map, whiteboard that, imagine whiteboarding that. Okay, let's accept that one. So let's now look at the phenomena that we do have evidence of in that context. And putting aside that there's reports of craft from very, you know, credentialed people, or that there is non-human biologicals, let's have a soft acceptance of that inside of this scenario. This, if we're going to do scenario, rapid scenario planning. Okay, if that's the case, now let's tease that out. What do we know? Well, the videos indicate that there are crafts. What are they doing? They're anthropological. They're on a research to figure out who we are, right? They're not threatening us intentionally, but they have superior technology, and that technology is either telerobotic or it's kind of what we have. We send drones to far places. It takes generations. Okay, maybe there's other folks that, forgetting about whether it's light speed or what the kind of technology they have, let's just accept it's here and that it comes from extraterrestrial sources of one of the trillions of worlds that is similar to ours. And why would they be coming here? Well, think about the rhetoric up to Elon Musk entering the scene. We were stuck in trying to get back to the moon. All of a sudden, Elon Musk comes along with Bezos and some other, you know, major digital industrials, and said, okay, let's create a private space industry. This has just happened. And all of a sudden, the possibility and the date and the time that we could actually leave our planet, right, is now scheduled. So all of a sudden, let's say that you are observing, if you are a civilization somewhat advanced technologically, you are now observing a paradigm shift in capabilities for this little planet that has not left except to go to their little moon. And they represent an intergalactic capability. You'd want to maybe study that. So I could make a case, and I made a case in the last chapter of my last book, where I talked about, I had a chronicle of a report by an extraterrestrial anthropologist who had been studying. And those studies, for all intents and purposes, led to a report. So if you take each of these scenarios and then you put aside what makes sense logically or not, and you tease them out, we might have different kind of observations of what's possible to be able to better analyze this, because I think it's probably one of the most fantastic innovations, or let's say breakthroughs, because we don't know and we're forced to look at scenarios that we never had to look at before.
My head is spinning. This is definitely a lot to take in. I want to revisit a couple things that you said earlier. You previously said that you kind of gave us this concept of a rogue party, and you know, they could be working on behalf of state, non-state actors or not, extraterrestrial, what have you. So with all of that in mind, what capacity does this type of phenomenon have to influence, impact, enhance disinformation operations, on top of that, neurological psyops? And then you also just alluded to, you know, public health and human safety. So kind of going into some of those specific aspects of it, how do you see this kind of impacting those specific things?
Having been early, involved in GWAT and all that, we've watched psyops evolve, right? My favorite psyops evolution was how it was eventually known as miso, which is, of course, a Japanese soup, which was made complete sense, right? So let's just say that we've come out of an era of IW, and psyops is evolving, and now, you know, you've got, is it possible, I don't know if you're going here, but I'll go there. Is it possible that this is a neuropsyops mass event, an IW mass event? Yes. And who would do that? Let's see. We would. So, you know, there's been a lot of stuff that occurred in the basement of the White House, which we know, total domain, you know, stuff that came out of an admiral one night that decided, you know, he wanted to implement a new technology. I'm just saying we haven't had a history of advanced IW, which now combined with where the internet is and visuals. And is it possible that there's a rationale and a motivation of us to have perfected a neuropsyops program to basically leapfrog our potential adversaries to signal, hey, we got the right stuff, right? Only Top Gun's here. And the answer is yes. That would be on my scenario board. I would say yes. And what would that look like? Well, it would kind of look like what we have. We can't catch them. They're moving faster than us. It's a superior technology. Well, whose interest would it be? You know, this is like following the money. Whose interest would it be for that to occur? Well, I could be in that room and I could tell you, gee, let's do this. Why? Because it would signal that we or a party, either a rogue or nation state or private sector defense contractor has a very sophisticated technology that represents who has it, could, let's say, create order through the display and demonstration of that. So the answer to that is yes, that's possible. You have to accept that. That is a possibility, okay? And there's a lot of technology. Now, it would be a perfect IW case that it comes from alien crashed vehicles that we reverse engineered. Wow, it's hard to prove that stuff up, man. I could run that. So yeah, is that possible? And maybe if you follow that logic path, right, it's likely, you know, that group in that wants that origin of that not to be validated. It's better that it be unknown. And I know at least one or two parties we've talked to that believe all of this UAP behavior, that most of it is ours, if not all of it. Or most of it is ours, and some of it may be one of our other adversaries, and they're playing at this level. And this stuff goes on. So there is an issue that, again, you could put these together, right? You would want to have craft that, in the event it did fall, would not be retrievable. What's the best way to do that? Make it toxic. Make it tetragenic. Make it carcinogenic. The assumption that, oh, it's unhealthy or it's a risk is because it's from an extraterrestrial source. Well, maybe it's not. Well, you know, so if you wanted to perpetrate a PSYOP scenario, you would make a craft or you would make something that, you know, you think about the entire chain of understanding. Now, I say that without saying it's the U.S. or another nation. It could be a contractor working from wherever. You think about Russia and China have outsourced almost all of their, you know, cyber to the private sector, which gives them complete plausible deniability. But they also, the private sector moves dirty and fast. And net take that model and you apply it to this scenario, I could whiteboard what that looks like. So if you accept Roswell as kind of the origin of that scenario, the first reports out of Roswell were that there was craft that had fell and they recovered bodies. That's the earliest stuff that was in the news that was taken locally. And then real quickly, it became balloons. So in other words, what I'm saying is, remember I said earlier, it's not binary. It's not this or that. It's likely a stack of things. And in the middle of the stack might be something like a true event, off-world event that occurs here, right? That could be a possibility. Other parts of the stack might be, we learned from that event. In our latest report at the Institute for Global Futures, we've identified every continent there have been sightings that line up, even Africa. There's more sightings in Latin America. They have tourist events around sightings. Well, I would say that let's accept that 70-80% of them are not real and whatever that, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, there's a serious 30-40%, the same phenomena. So somebody is staging something that would take an enormous amount of capital resources, a big lift, we call it a big lift. So therefore, you'd have somebody that capitalized a real event, and the real event could be a contractor working for a sovereign is showcasing their capabilities. And somebody else looks at that and goes, wow, that'd be great for us to integrate into our IW. And somebody else says, hey, you know, let's use that for That's the real world. There's also likely a scenario where you've got parties that have that are exploiting opportunities. We know in our bag eye hunting that there are folks that have exploited technology whether it's drones, it doesn't have to be missiles, it could be a variety of things to their advantage. So you could have multiple players, good guys, bad guys, in a new kind of gray war, which is utilizing a stack of capabilities, not unlike multiple domain. I remember when cyberspace was not part of the multi-domain engagement, and space was not part of the engagement. And I led efforts of strategic planning that ended up changing some of those narrow ways of thinking. Should we now be thinking of space as part of this, and therefore just the way we've now thought about cyberspace? Should we think about AIs as rogues, not just technology that we're programming? Yes. Should we think about gray parties who are contractors, not necessarily sovereigns, who have advanced technology? Because autonomy was something that our government has a mandate on technology that the kill chain will never include complete autonomy. I can tell you right now, there's three countries that don't believe that. Is it possible that they develop something that got away and now has its own agenda? Yeah, yeah. So these are the kind of scenarios. I'm not bound by what Jim is, and I'm not bound by the same things that he is. I can speculate about these things, you know, to complement his fairly rational way of looking at it. I'm just saying we're in an advanced innovation economy. We're the largest company in the U.S. marketplace on the stock market is a chip company that is, I mean, NVIDIA is bigger than Apple and every other company. It's the biggest company and most valuable company in the world. So we're dealing in an era of rapid innovation velocity and its convergence. So, do you know, I don't know anybody that can really master the convergence of nanobio, IT, neuro, and quantum, that original work we did at the National Science Foundation, because it requires thinking outside the box. But also there are some people that probably have, and some of them are good guys and some of them are bad guys.
So as always, whenever we identify a new threat or a novel threat, we have to ask the question, what should we be doing now? How should the U.S. and the military prepare for something like this?
Yeah, I think it's a bit premature because there hasn't been a formal ask. And the formal ask always has to be defined by the group or individuals that are asking. Congressional, senatorial, higher up, changing administration. So it's like standby to standby. But I think at very, very least, what's going to be required here is some increased level and measures of transparency. Governmental transparency, whole of governmental transparency in a coordinated effort. I mean, again, this need not in any way divulge or disclose any information that is maintained to be classified with regard to national security and defense. But I think transparency with regard to national security and defense in the public interest is equally, if not more important. So realistically, what we're really calling for are the three basic recommendations. Please understand, once again, I'm speaking here as an individual. I'm not speaking on the part of the Department of Defense or any one of those governmental entities for whom my work has been supported. First, that there needs to be the appointment of an official point of contact who's representative of the subject matter expert in the multidimensionality of these events as they exist as a viable risk space. This needs to be someone who's able to at least liaise to a whole of government, not only nationally, but a multinational collaboration, whole of governments and whole of nations, that allow the kind of cooperation that would be necessary for information acquisition, analysis, and then, of course, parsing and dissemination. That's number one. Number two, there needs to be an increased transparency of any and all of the information without necessarily disclosure of United States national security, intelligence, and defense interests that are relevant to public health and public safety. As I defined earlier, those five risk domains, both possible as well as perhaps very viable risk domains in terms of at least psychological effects and what they incur, need to be directly addressed. And directly address simply by going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Are there risks here? Are there risks there? Are there risks there, et cetera? And if there are risks, number one, what are the risks? And number two, what's being done to at least address, if not mitigate or prevent those risks? And then third, I think that there needs to be a multidisciplinary committee that is established that remains flexible so as to be able to sustain oversight for actionable information, both acquisition, analysis, and provision. And there needs to be increased clarity between those groups and organizations and entities that are actually doing the boots on the ground examinative investigative work, and an increased reliance upon, if you will, whole of nation assets. So realistically, here we go back to the triple helix: government interfacing with the civilian research enterprise, interfacing with the commercial entities in such a way as to preserve actionable information, acquisition, analysis, and then actionable effort towards reducing burdens and risks in a way that is transparent to the public. Now, again, when we talk about that unity of government, academia, and the commercial spaces, one of the questions that keeps coming up over and over again is what needs to be, quote, declassified to allow that to happen. I disagree. I think that's not the right approach. The approach is to keep many things classified as they need be, but to also engage the necessary processes to be able to vet subject matter experts who can then gain the classification necessary to be read into those specific compartments or SAPs that are going to be able to provide the necessary guidance for these three levels of recommended actionable engagements to be able to address, communicate, and mitigate these viable risks.
Having worked on other kinds of things like this, like when we stood up the National Science and Technology Council, had supported the early stages, it was called the Interagency Working Group on Nanoscience and Nanoengineering. I was the private sector representative. I didn't know until I showed up at the meeting and all the agency heads were there. And they basically said, thank you for joining the council. And I said, who chairs this? And they said, oh, yeah, it's chaired by the president. Well, the point is, we've had a history of, I would say, from my framework, accelerated development of key innovations that have driven policy, economics, and superiority in terms of, you know, military, that have all come from being able to rally around and support in various ways across the Defense Department, as well as the White House, the executive branch, and let's say the judicial, and all branches working together to work. All right, so let me put that aside. What could be done now? Right now, what I would do, and feel free, you can edit everything I said up to this point out, is we need to look at these scenarios from a strategic planning point of view. So the work project that I was very, very proud of was something called Strategic Appreciation, and it was a work product created by SOCOM and then adopted by Joint Chiefs under Admiral Olson. And what it was an attempt to look at the, pardon the pun, but it was based on my trend convergence. That was my contribution, trend convergence of different kinds of trends that together converged and created opportunities or unfolded risks. What we need to do is better scenario planning for this, and not with the usual suspects, meaning, you know, bringing in people like myself who are more private sector than government sector that has advised government, you know, bringing in people who can say, okay, let's look at what the scenarios are that we need to better understand in order to create real change here. And I don't mean set up, you know, a SAP or set up 20 committees. I'm talking about rapid strategic planning, where you look at scenarios, you hit them hard, you get them done in real time. Nobody leaves the room. You know, I had a 3-star that told me the best way he did meetings was everybody, there were no chairs, there was whiteboards. Everybody stood, believe me, you got everything done before you left. So that kind of rapid, I think, at this point, scenario development, and let's just assume for a moment, and I'm going to make a bold forecast, that there are likely parties that know more about who that has been classified for some probably very good reasons. But if I was just looking at this to be agnostic and say, how could we appreciate what the scenarios are, the good, bad, and ugly, I think that work could be done immediately. And people could be, you know, briefed who are driving that. So at least we have the playbook for what the possibilities are, how to engage for each scenario, how to prepare an all of government response. And I think that that would be something that could be done, not like a 6-month project. You know, as somebody who helped create the model of strategic planning for business industry, and then to a certain extent, the military, I played a role in all that. You know, we don't need a task force that's going to deliver some, you know, paper in 7 to 15 months. That may be useful too, but we need a rapid approach to figure stuff out now. That's what I would do, scenario development. And then I would implement that and have people own those scenarios to be able to investigate and then figure out, you know, what do we need? What are the resources, intel we need, support we need to be able to prove that up? For instance, there likely is, I've had independent reports, my Institute for Global Futures, we've had independent reports where there have been some sightings of things that are questionable, where there has been a concern for people getting ill, and there have been reports in the congressional oversight reports that people have been injured. And we suspect that if that's the case, it could be extraterrestrial from the point that it's radiological, or it produces an effect on human biology. So that would be something that would live in the scenario. So I think a good, bad, and ugly scenario, rapid scenario that could be then an organic thing, could be updated. Like, I think that would be the smartest thing we could do now to get out in front of this, as opposed to kind of waiting for the next shoe to drop.
So before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to give any final words. You know, if we didn't bring up a topic that you wanted to talk about, so feel free to go anywhere you want on this one.
Well, you know, in summary, I would say that my sense is that it may be a variety of origin sources, technologies, characters, actors. Some are rogue, some are friendly, some may even be us. Some may be extraterrestrial, some may be interdimensional. Is it possible that the evolution of our civilization has gotten the interest in of parties that are in other time, space, dimensions, not necessarily extra-dimensional, but also extraterrestrial? Is it possible we live in that kind of a world? Well, I would say the likelihood is we live in that kind of world. Is this the first intrusion or evidence of that? I could make a case for that scenario. Do I think there's a greater likelihood of it being terrestrial and outside of our expertise, or is it part of a larger campaign to be able to, let's say, level the playing field or send signals regarding our technological capabilities? That is possible too. We don't know enough, but we know it represents a new threat matrix that is existential and is important to understand. And I think it's an exciting time to be able to investigate this in order to figure out what it is. And we should not throw out any scenarios of anything that sounds absurd, because we've learned that anything is possible in a world of increased technologies and advancing sciences that have, quite frankly, improved the quality of life as well as improved our defense posture and capabilities to advance our nation's interest in terms of national security.
Well, Dr. Canton, this has been one of the more interesting conversations we've had on this podcast. I seem to say that every time you guys come on the show, though. I think you just keep one-upping yourselves. So we thank you for coming on and talking to us about this. It's a very interesting concept in terms of, we're trying to think about and plan for something that we know very little about. So that's always the toughest, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying or shouldn't be planning. So thank you for coming on. Thank you for talking with us. And hopefully we will see you on here again.
Yeah, no, listen, I'm very excited. This is your, you know, you're a bold group, right? In fact, I've had a number of people, even in defense intelligence in the private sector, said, hey, where are they distributed? I think it's on Spotify. Do you do a promotion for this and stuff like that?
So we are on Spotify. You can find us on Apple Podcasts.
Okay, great. You know, I always promote it when it comes out as such, but I think the more people can learn from MadSci, I think the better it is. But I do like the idea when I call up, and I'm very proud to be part of the MadSci community. I do call up and I say, you know, I'm a member of a small, quiet government organization. Could we have a talk? And they go, what's it called? And I go, The Mad Scientist Initiative. Anyway, I've been at those meetings. I've been at the table. So what I'm saying to you is, having worked with four administrations at the highest levels of cabinet, presidents, and certainly generals, I can tell you that the work Mad Scientist does is real. You're doing really important work. You don't realize it because maybe you do realize it, but they need this kind of alternative thinking and even outrageous futures. Why? Because people get really stuck in the normal kind of stuff and the fires they need to put out, and they need to think, because the threat matrix has changed. You know, it's no longer we need a new tank. No, you need no more tanks. How long, if we go beyond Mach 5, Mach 7, will humans live in a craft? No, you don't need humans in the craft. You need them to telerobotically control it. So just even that kind of thinking is still, I had a fight when I was doing, I introduced AI to IC and DOD at a couple of different stages, even the internet. It originally was, I mean, you guys are young. I mean, they threw out every innovative idea until adversaries picked it up, and they had a, you know, until people drove planes into buildings. And you'd be surprised how much we change from disaster versus logic or education. So you're doing important work. You need to know that. It's important. That's why if you had a mailing list of everybody on the Joint Chiefs, and that's what I'm saying, stuff like that, they still respond to. That's the way it used to be. But you're doing important work. So you should know that these conversations are conversations that others should be embracing. So I hope they will be listening.
Well, that's great to hear, and we appreciate those kind words. And that's always our goal, is to avoid the operational surprise. We don't want our adversary to be doing that first, and we find out about them on the battlefield. So well put, sir. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. James Giordano and Dr. James Canton. You can follow us on social media at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.